quick, when you hear the name Mary Todd Lincoln, what do you think? And I mean, aside from being the wife of Abraham Lincoln, do you think a little unhinged, a little, I don't know, too much? The first lady who was always making a scene? For 150 years, she's had this reputation. Volatile, histrionic, extravagant, overbearing. In her new biography of Mary Lincoln, Lois Romano says it's true. She could be all of those things. But she was also charismatic and politically astute. And Romano believes she was so important to Lincoln's rise that she doesn't believe he would have become president without her. And she says there's another word to describe Mary Lincoln. Resilient. This was a woman who endured a traumatic childhood, the death of three of her four children, the assassination of her husband. But if that wasn't enough, 10 years later, her only surviving son took her to court. He wanted her declared insane and committed to a sanatorium. Romano says the hearing in a courtroom in downtown Chicago was an ambush.
Mary has been a widow for 10 years, and she's become a little bit eccentric. And her son decides that she needs to be institutionalized. Among the reasons that he decides is that she's shopping too much. She has also, for the past decade since Lincoln's assassination, been seeing spiritualists. Another thing that drives her last living son just crazy. So he makes a decision that she has to be taken off the street. And he engineers a sham trial. He puts out a warrant for her arrest. He rounds up a bunch of doctors. He gets them all to say she's insane. The judge buys into this, and it's packed. There's 300 people in the room. The doors open, and there's Mary, all 5 foot two of her, and she has to walk the whole length of the courthouse up to her seat. So they do this so-called trial, and the witnesses are the shopkeepers who sold her all these goods, now all of a sudden are testifying that she looked insane when she came in and bought jewelry. She looked kind of crazy when she bought watches. But they took her money and sold her the goods. Then the next round of witnesses were the people in the hotel who said that she acted very peculiar, and she probably did act a little peculiar. She was on some medications, and she was hallucinating a little bit. So she was acting a little oddly. And then we had her son testifying, and the sensational Chicago media most definitely took her son's side. I mean, they're talking about how she looked crazy and her eyes were darting around, but Robert's eyes were infused with tears and how painful it is. And Robert complained during the whole testimony that she shopped too much, that she was buying jewelry and she never wore jewelry. She was buying dresses and all she did was dressed in black. And he used the word heed. She wouldn't heed my wishes like she was supposed to do that. And then you had the doctors testifying that she needed to be institutionalized. So there's 3 hours of this, and then they all retreat to deliberate, and they declare her insane in 10 minutes. And so Robert gets her committed to a sanitarium about an hour outside of Chicago.
You write in the book that as the trial reached its crescendo, her fall from grace was final and complete, or so it seemed. And then you have this little coda to that section where you say she was still standing, and that not for the first time, men had underestimated her. Talk about what this story says about this moment and this woman.
Well, for that split moment, she was defeated. I mean, I will tell you that. She wasn't defeated for long. But men had underestimated her entire life. People had underestimated her. But I found it interesting that her own son had underestimated her will. And he thought that he had buttoned this whole thing up. And he had, in a way, because he got the conviction that he wanted. And she was humiliated. And then Robert made a very big mistake. He went on vacation. And she's now going to be on a mission to get out of there. And the long and short of it is, by the end of the summer, the medical director was saying to Robert, I think she's doing just fine and she needs to get out of here. And she was out. The only thing left was to get her money, and that was a big fight. Robert had to agree to that. And finally, even his own advisors were saying, you just need to let it go. It's over. Give her her money back. And she immediately left for Europe. She's complicated, but she also helped elect the most consequential president in history. And that got overlooked. And what we inherited was a story that was filtered through myth and bias and just incomplete information. The Mary that we inherited was extravagant, unstable, difficult, you know, insane, when she was very, very smart and actually a consequential first lady.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lois Romano is with us for the hour. Her new book is called An Inconvenient Widow. The book grew out of her years as a Washington journalist and her effort to understand how Mary Todd Lincoln had become one of the most misunderstood women in American history.
I covered first ladies as a journalist for The Washington Post, and she just stuck with me. And she first came to my attention when I was covering Hillary Clinton when she was first lady. And Hillary was just being pilloried. And I, you know, I'm not here to carry a brief for Hillary Clinton, but some of the criticism that she received was somewhat unfair. And that happened to Mary, too. And I was curious that why Mary? And I came to realize that Mary was actually probably one of the first modern first ladies. She had an unprecedented amount of press scrutiny.
Yeah.
She was highly educated. She was a very strong, powerful surrogate for Lincoln during the war. And I just thought, here is a guy who is an icon. And as I said, the most consequential, one of the most consequential presidents in history, he picked her. And so she couldn't have been that bad. That was sort of my thought. And what did we miss here? And I wanted to go back and take a look at that. And what made it challenging in a lot of ways was because there was a fixed image of her. You know, her image and her legacy was formed by, I like to say, three men.
Mm.
And it was distorted, and they were influential men. And so at that time, we didn't cover first ladies as much, so nobody really cared. So that story of her just being crazy and a drag on Lincoln and all these things, that just carried forward for 100 years. And those three men were her son, who got her labeled as insane, one of Lincoln's former law partners, a guy named William Herndon, and an associate justice of the Supreme Court named David Davis, who was also a crony of Lincoln's, who ended up being the executor of the estate.
Yeah.
And David Davis wouldn't release the estate. I mean, he really made her suffer. I mean, he put in an allowance of the equivalent of $50,000 a year for 2 years when there was a lot of money there. And he kept saying he was settling the estate. But in truth, there was nothing to settle. It should have been settled within a year because Lincoln had one debt, an $11 newspaper subscription that hadn't been paid. And the only reason he finally settled the estate after 2.5 years is because Mary went to New York to sell her clothes. And that became this big scandal. And, you know, she got pilloried for it.
Yeah.
And it was so embarrassing to Robert and to Davis that he released the estate at that point.
Yeah. Let's back up and talk about her upbringing, which I found, well, I can't say I knew that much about Mary Lincoln, you know, beyond her relationship with Abraham Lincoln. But she grows up in the Athens of the West, Lexington, Kentucky, which used to be this kind of dingy frontier town. But, you know, at the time, it's this sort of, you know, this hub of commerce, as you describe it. And she is with this, she's born into this wealthy family. And beyond that, beyond the sort of, you know, material affluence that they have, I think her education is really interesting. You write about how her father and her, you know, stepmother were really progressive thinkers. They had a Mary Wollstonecraft book in the home. She was educated. She was thoughtful. She learns to speak French. Talk a little bit about that part of her life.
All of what you just said and more. It was Lexington was an incredibly sophisticated community, and the Todds, her family, the Todds, were sort of the aristocracy of Lexington. By the time Mary was born, there were private schools, there were multiple churches, there were four or five newspapers, there was a university, there was a theater. There, some of the streets were paved, and there were really nice shops. There were silver shops and haberdasheries, and a French bakery that she would love to visit and speak to the proprietor in French. And her family was very well heeled. The Todds helped founded Kentucky, and they helped founded Lexington. So, and she kind of had this. It was a bifurcated upbringing because on the one hand you had that, but then on the other hand, her mom died in childbirth when Mary was 6 years old. And that was traumatic. She was the fourth of five kids. And her father left the house right away to work and to also try to find a wife to take care of these kids. And Mary was sort of left there, you know, in the middle and being taken care of by a rotating group of caretakers, some of the father's relatives, her mother's mother, and enslaved people. They were slave owners.
Yep.
So Mary is brought up, and then a year and a half later, far, far earlier than what was socially acceptable, her father finds a bride, and he marries this woman, Betsy Humphreys. And then Betsy goes on to have nine more children.
The question I think will come up for people, like, was she always so volatile and high strung? And you deal with that in the book. But you also say that at the time, no one really saw her volatility as anything more than just this kind of smart girl who was, you know,
precocious,
exactly. But she also, people did identify, and you mentioned this in the book.
They did identify, and that's really interesting. And we're very, very lucky, Doug, to have that in writing, you know, to have letters. I think someone called her that her personality as a young woman was like an April day.
Right.
That one day she would be sunny and bright.
Yeah.
And then like an hour later, she'd be in a tantrum or she'd be crying. Mm. And so they saw that in her, but they also saw and she had a sharp mouth. And I attribute that to self-protection. You know, they said she was sarcastic. But she was also the star. She was the star pupil in the school. She ended up attending a boarding school right in Lexington. And I think she attended a boarding school just to get out of her house because that house was just so chaotic and crowded. And so she would the coachman would take her to the school on Monday morning and then pick her up on Friday afternoon. And she said that was like her second home. She called her childhood desolate in many ways because she was so lonely. And even though this house was full of people, she was very, very lonely. But to go back to your point, yes, people saw the personality, but they also saw the brilliance. She loved acting in the plays. She was fluent in French. And she was the first lady to enter the White House more educated than her husband.
Yeah. You mentioned this Chicago doctor, William Evans, who does this study in the 1930s, which you describe as probably the best analysis of kind of what was going on with her, which was epigenetics. It was some hereditary, some environmental factors. I mean, you know, erratic home life, the trauma of losing her mother, of being probably neglected in some ways. And it gives you a sense of where she's coming from. And I think that's important to say.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. That's really true. She, you know, people come out of crisis in different ways. And Mary learned to be a survivor, but losing her mother didn't really toughen her. She never could deal with loss very well. And so what Evans concludes is that she wasn't given coping mechanisms. Instead, she would have, you know, anxiety attacks, basically. And she became needy. I mean, and so these traits that she had, you know, being precocious and smart, they were sort of charming when she was younger. But later they became a little bit annoying to people personally.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people just thought she was imperious and you know, narcissistic, although I don't think she was narcissistic, but some people thought that. I think she was just, her whole life was in survival mode. And, you know, we haven't even gotten to the fact that she was losing children along the way.
Yeah.
And that was helping to shape her and putting her into another spiral.
You mentioned that there were these questions when the Civil War is raging, when her husband is president, of course, about where her alliances were with the South or with the North. Say a little bit about her relationship with slavery. You mentioned her father owned a number of enslaved people. They romanticized those relationships.
She did romanticize slavery a little bit, but they treated their enslaved people well. But Mary's young, right? So she doesn't understand that she thinks these people want to be there. Like, she can't imagine that they'd want to leave. And they're part of her household. And they raised her.
Yeah.
And so at one point she says, you know, I don't think, you know, Mammy Sally would want to leave us. And she doesn't quite understand that they don't have a choice. And she definitely was not pro-slavery. But she didn't, I think in her youth, she didn't know enough about it to be anti-slavery.
Mm. One of the things we should also mention is that Mary Lincoln was, by the way, I want to say something about the, people always say Mary Todd Lincoln. Why do you think they say that? Because she didn't keep that name. She didn't hyphenate her name. How do you understand that?
It's unclear. And in fact, it's funny. I went back and forth on the title of the book, and we kept the Todd in it because it had rhythm. But at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, they do not use it because she never used it.
Yeah.
And I don't know when it got inserted. I have no idea.
Was it a way of distancing her in some weird way from...
No, I don't think so. I think it was a way that early biographers identified where she came from, that she was a Todd.
Well, I think the Todds, that's a good segue into something I wanted to ask you about, which was that she was politically sophisticated before she meets Abraham Lincoln. I mean, she grows up inside one of Kentucky's most sort of politically influential families. She develops this, it seems like you kind of portray this sophisticated understanding of political personalities and elections and public opinion, which seemed unique for women who were excluded from formal politics of that time.
Well, and this she has her father to thank. I mean, her father, you know, had a beautiful home on Main Street that still stands and is a museum, and influential people would come through there. Powerful politicians, if they were visiting, would come through there, and bankers and merchants. And they discussed the issues of the day. And Henry Clay was a family friend. And at that time, Henry Clay was a pretty hot politician. I mean, he had run for president 3 or 4 times. He had been Speaker of the House. He was Secretary of State. I mean, he was a prominent political player and a Whig. And so she would be invited for dessert. You know, the kids, anybody who wanted to come could come. And so she became a very sophisticated political operative.
Lois Romano. We're talking about her book. It's called An Inconvenient Widow, The Torment, Trial, and Triumph of Mary Todd Lincoln. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So for more than a century and a half, Mary Todd Lincoln has been remembered as the difficult wife of Abraham Lincoln. Emotional, extravagant, unstable, and yes, the journalist Lois Romano says she was a hard woman to like. But she thinks at least you ought to know why. In her new book, Romano explores how politics and grief and mental illness, not to mention Lincoln's own transformation into an American saint, all helped turn a complicated woman into a historical caricature. Her book is called An Inconvenient Widow. You write this in the book, that she, when she meets Abraham Lincoln, of course, she intended to help make him president. Now, I want to talk about the relationship between Abraham Lincoln and Mary Lincoln, because in the book, I want to read something that you write in the book, because the question is, like, what did they see in each other? What was their, how do you describe their relationship? And this is how you put it in the book. You said that they had come to terms with their needs and feelings for each other and found solace in commencing a partnership rooted in family and mutual interests. So you're saying that they developed this, they had gotten engaged and it was broken off, and we'll come back to that in a minute, but they developed this entirely new, deeper relationship that you write about. They had become friends in some ways also, committed to this goal. So what are you getting at there in terms of that relationship? It was, yes, they loved each other. Yes, there was a spark, but there was also something else in there. And then I find that really interesting.
They both came from troubling backgrounds, yeah, in a way. I mean, Mary's was affluent and Lincoln's was poor. But Lincoln had to self-educate. His father wouldn't support his education. He wanted, and his father was jealous of Lincoln. He didn't want him to be spending time reading books. He wanted him to be working in the fields. They both lost their mothers at a young age. And they both found solace in each other emotionally. There was an emotional connection that they had. And they also had a very deep political connection. These were two extremely ambitious souls. I mean, they were very, you can't overestimate their ambition. Lincoln was very ambitious. Mary was very ambitious. Lincoln had some tools and Mary had other tools. Lincoln was a brilliant politician himself. He was a tactician. Mary helped soften his edges. She understood connections where Lincoln was a little bit awkward, and she would open up her home in Springfield. Whenever the legislature would sit, she would open it up to 500 people, even though the house wasn't that big, but people would come in and out and spill out over the lawn. She understood the guest list, and she understood that he needed to be around these people. So she helped position him. And I don't, this is not to take anything away from Abraham Lincoln. He was impeccable orator and an amazing politician. But Mary was right there on the front lines with him. And I'm going to say this, and I've said this before, I do not think he would have been president without her. And here's why. He was also a depressive.
Right.
And it's very well documented. In fact, when they broke up, he had in every respect, he had a nervous breakdown. His friends took dangerous items out of his boarding house. They thought he might hurt himself.
Yeah, remove the razor blades, right? Yeah.
And remove the razor blades, right. Mary had mania. So they both had mental illness. His mental illness did not define him. Hers did. Mm-hmm. There was a history of him being in a funk. Yeah. And he would go into, one friend said, a trance where you couldn't snap him out of it. Mm-hmm. He would just completely self-absorb. And she would get him out of it. She'd say, you're going to be a senator. You're going to be president. You know, you're better than all these men. And he would quote her. He would say, well, Mary thinks I'm going to be president. Isn't that funny? Who else would think that? But I think she really, boosted him up. Mm-hmm. She was 100% for him. The reason I'm saying this, and I'm not saying it, it's not just my opinion. There's research in the book that supports it, that even people that did not like Mary said that she was a very powerful force on him. Mm. She was, she could judge people very well. She had a very instinctual sense of political people when people were working for them or against them, and that she had an energy that he didn't have initially, that he was sort of laconic. And she was like the Energizer Bunny. So even people that came to dislike her said she did the deed. Mm. She helped catapult him. He had all the skills and the brilliance, and she helped push him over the finish line.
You don't really deal with this question in the book, but I want to get to this episode that happens in 1840. That they had become engaged, but shortly after, Lincoln breaks it off. He goes into this, like, really profoundly, as sort of as you were just talking about, one of these episodes where he is disconsolate. And one of the questions that comes up, and one of the reasons that he is because he has this friend, Joshua Speed. And there are these arguments out there that this breakup was connected to this relationship with this friend, Joshua Speed. And you write about the fact that, as you say in the book, the prospect of losing Speed's calming presence compounded, you know, Abraham Lincoln's sense of self-doubt, and that they were they had this unusually, this is your words, unusually close relationship. They found solace in discussing their forebodings about sexuality, was a quote that you put in there. And there's this question that comes up, I'm sure you've heard, again, that you don't really deal with in the book, is that Abraham Lincoln was gay. This was a gay relationship. He goes into a, you know, this profound sense of depression because Joshua Speed is also getting married. What do you make of that, you know, question?
It's a very good question, you know. And I get it a lot, and I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I suppose it's possible that he was gay. And during that time, as we know, during the 19th century, you couldn't be gay and survive, certainly. But that you can actually build a case for him not being gay as well. Like, you know, people say, well, he lived with Joshua Speed. Joshua Speed invited him to live above the store with him that he owned.
Yeah.
And they slept in the same bed. But this was not uncommon during this period of time. Lincoln also slept in the same bed with a lot of lawyers when they were on the circuit. I have also, by reading the few letters that exist between Mary and Lincoln, I feel like they had a strong sexual relationship. I can't swear to that, but you can see some longing in their letters.
Yeah.
And they definitely did family planning, because when the second child dies, she immediately gets pregnant. And I don't know the answer, but I think that they did have a strong sexual bond as well, a physical bond, Mary and Lincoln. And maybe he did with Joshua too. I don't know. My personal opinion is I don't think he was gay. I think he just formed an attachment to Speed, because they were both two lost souls. But I mean, who knows? I think somebody did write a book on this once, and I don't know the answer.
Yeah. Let's talk about when Mary Lincoln's effect on her husband's beliefs and, like, political beliefs and aspirations. It's interesting. You write about the fact that she doesn't really take a public role. Like, she wasn't a women's rights activist. So what's the role that she plays? She's sort of, what, whispering in his ear, saying, I'll have a tea party for you, or, like, how does it work?
Well, there's policy and there's politics, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't take her as a policy person. She was a very shrewd political operator. And I think his politics were her politics. So whatever he believed, she believed 100%.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to preserve the union. She wanted to preserve the union. So I think she saw her role as protecting him politically. For example, she was opposed to him appointing William Seward Secretary of State, because she said, he will take credit for everything you do. He's going to undermine you, and he'll betray you. And Lincoln, I think, knew that as well. But Seward was supposed to be the nominee of the party. He was most powerful member of the party at that point. And I think Lincoln felt he needed him, and he probably did. But everything Mary predicted, it turned out to be true in the first 3 months. Seward tried to undermine Lincoln. He wrote Lincoln a memo that basically said, you know, you don't have a foreign policy. You don't have a domestic policy. Why don't you just go out and be a figurehead and I'll run the government? So Mary just had his number. She also understood this about Simon Chase, who became the Treasury Secretary. And Lincoln at one point says to her, you know, Mary, if I was to listen to you, I wouldn't even have a cabinet, because you don't like any of these people. Well, fast forward 4 years later, and Simon Chase is quietly trying to run for president against Lincoln.
Mm.
So she had a very good intuitive sense. She was also a voracious newspaper reader. And she socialized a lot. So she was out there with the gossip, listening, her nose to the grindstone. I mean, she knew everything that was happening. So I think in those ways, she was able to help him. I think that he did listen to her. I don't think that he took all of her advice. Mm. I think he welcomed what she was saying. But I think Lincoln was pretty strong. I think he did whatever he was. He made all the decisions. So anybody that suggests otherwise, but I think he appreciated Mary's insights and political acumen.
You say in the book that Mary Lincoln's conflicted legacy was most negatively influenced by, you mentioned three men before, but one in particular, William Herndon. I wanted to come back to that. You say in the 1840s, this marks the beginning of this sort of strange, poisonous odyssey, and that they took an instant dislike to each other. How do you understand that, his antipathy toward Mary Lincoln?
I think it starts with her antipathy. I think she doesn't like him from the get-go.
Huh.
And she thinks that she doesn't understand. Lincoln could have, at that point in his career, he could have chosen anybody to be his law partner. He was making a name for himself, traveling the circuit. And he chooses a guy who had just been, a young student or an intern in his office. He was also a drunk. Herndon was a drunk. And Mary just thought he was also an abolitionist, and that was not a good place to be at that time. Hmm. And Mary just thought that he was could be harmful to Lincoln. And once Lincoln had to bail him out of jail, and she refused for being drunk, and she refused to invite him to her home for dinner. And I think that's what triggered everything. And he just couldn't stand her. And other people would get invited to dinner. A new clerk would come through the office, and that young man would get invited to dinner. Not only would he get invited to dinner, Mary would ask him, this other young man, if he would escort her to parties when Lincoln was out of town, of course, with Lincoln's permission. And if you read through all of Herndon's letters, and it's all about that she rejected him. Like he's always talking about her dinner parties and how she only invites the aristocracy. And then he would create these stories about how after the dinner party, she would yell at Lincoln till he left the house. And how would he know that? Because he wasn't at the dinner parties. and that Lincoln would show up in the office early in the morning to get away from her. And we have no idea that's why Lincoln showed up early in the morning, except that he was sort of a loner and moody. The other thing that contradicts Herndon is that he also says that Lincoln never confided in him. He said, so Lincoln never, you can't find a bad word that Lincoln ever said about Mary. Hmm. I mean, you can find third-hand stories where a guy says, yeah, this guy told me he said this about her once, but there's not one written word, and Lincoln was a big letter writer. So they develop a terribly toxic relationship, Mary and Herndon, and he just never forgives her for this. And Lincoln's and Herndon's relationship effectively ends when he gets elected president in 1860. But Herndon keeps the law practice going for a little bit. He only sees Lincoln one more time after that. He goes to Washington to visit him and tries to get a job appointment for somebody else, mm-hmm. not himself. And Mary doesn't come out to greet him. And so he's very angry about that, too. And then he has to borrow money from Lincoln to get back to Illinois. So he's humiliated. And all of this, he never wants to put it on Lincoln. So it's all on Mary. Hmm.
There's an image you write about. The chapter heading is Mrs. Lincoln Goes to Washington. This is 1847. Her husband, of course, is elected to Congress. In October, they make the trip to, she's got two toddlers. They head to Washington. And she's just 28 years old. I just found that really interesting and kind of striking. We think of her as a sort of...
It's striking that she went. It was very right? unusual.
Yeah, talk about that.
That a woman, at that time, maybe 20% of wives maybe accompany their husband. They certainly didn't accompany them with kids. Mm. So these might have been, some older representatives. She decides she's just going to go. I mean, she's worked hard for this. And she, as one of Lincoln's friends say, she wants to loom large in Washington. And so they take the trek across country and they have to move into a rooming house with toddlers. And it's just not anything it's cracked up to be. First of all, Lincoln's a junior congressman. Mm-hmm. So they're not being invited to anything fancy or special. And Mary can't entertain anymore because they're in a rooming house with a lot of people. And the kids are there getting underfoot. And Lincoln's working all the time. So she leaves after 6 months. I mean, she's just totally miserable and leaves. But it just was very unusual that she even went.
Lois Romano. Her book is An Inconvenient Widow: The Torment, Trial, and Triumph of Mary Todd Lincoln. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now to a conversation with Lois Romano. We're talking about her biography of Mary Todd Lincoln. It's called An Inconvenient Widow. I liked this section where you write about their home life in Washington and the way that they had a dog named Fido. He would sort of wrestle with the kids. It did seem like kind of domestic bliss. They seemed
this
like
is in Springfield, in Illinois.
Sorry, in Springfield. Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about? She also you write about the there was one. Well, there's one moment where she's like, we're not eating until Dad comes home. And, you know, dinner's burnt or cold by then.
She was very protective of him. Huh. And we lose a lot of this. She was also a high-strung mother. I mean, so there's some funny stories in there about she would get hysterical if a kid was missing. Yeah. And she would get, very overwrought. But, people who came through their home saying it was a warm environment. And he would play with the kids on the floor all the time. And Lincoln and Mary were both intellectuals, and they would read to each other. And Lincoln loved poetry. Mary loved poetry. And Lincoln once said, if Mary reads a book, I don't have to read it because she can just tell me what it's about. And there were some negative reports of Mary. She was apparently very stingy during this time. They weren't making a lot of money. And, Lincoln's niece didn't like her. She came to be a nanny and go to school. And she said that Mary was just very stingy about putting food on the table. She was always fighting with the help, and the help was always quitting. Mary's just very anxious, and as you say, she could be dislikable. She once has a fight with the guy who delivers ice, and she starts haggling with him, and then she won't pay him because she thinks he's overcharging her for the ice. And then he leaves in a huff, but he's the only game in town, so she has to go send a young kid to apologize to him and tell him to come back with the ice, and she pays him.
What have you learned about her, her affection for, if not obsession, with shopping? It's one of the things that comes up a lot when people are thinking about her. But she loved to shop. I mean, later she had her own money to do it, and why people were keeping her from it when she could afford it, that was like her son, is interesting. But what do you make of that?
Okay, I think she had a shopping addiction, and yeah. I'm not going to color that
right.
any other way.
Yeah.
However, let's step back for a second and think about it as sort of the intersection of psychology, politics, ambition, and grief, okay? Mm-hmm. So she gets to the White House, and it's a mess. It's run down. It's rats are running all around the place. The wallpaper's peeled. Every White House gets money to be renovated, and she was no exception. So she goes out and shops. Where she makes a mistake is that she's not discreet about it. She's shopping, and she overran the budget. Again, not unusual. People put it in another part of the appropriations bill. But she bought a lot of stuff and high-end stuff when the country was going to war and the Treasury was running out of money. So the juxtaposition of that was not good optics. But the other things that were going on is that she's like visiting encampments. She's going to factories that are making uniforms. She's going to the front lines. She went to an abolitionist church in Brooklyn, New York, which would have been unheard of before then. But she gets no credit for any of that. So the initial shopping, I think, was somewhat justified. She didn't understand the optics. Later, it becomes more to fulfill a need. As she's experiencing losses and she's insecure, she likes going into the stores when he's president, and she's buying everything on credit. Everybody's fawning all over her, and the bills are going to come. This is when she's shopping personally. She's buying gowns, and she's running up a lot of debt. But she likes that everybody is fawning on her, and she's buying beautiful dresses and fabrics, and by the time he dies, she's in debt. Now, to her credit, she did figure out a way to pay it off. So She somewhat corrected the error. As she's getting older, she does have some money, and she's still shopping, but you can see it at that point as really just filling an emptiness. Mm. She's walking into stores, and she's buying stuff for her kids, too. She's buying stuff for Robert and his and her grandchildren, but she's also filling a need. I mean, she's going into stores, and she's buying things she doesn't need. She's buying curtains, and she doesn't have a house. She's buying jewelry, and she stopped wearing jewelry. So she definitely had a disorder, but we didn't understand it back then. We do understand it now, and I can't remember what it's called. I say what it's called. It's a compulsive disorder.
Yeah.
But she had a lot of compulsions, and one of them was the shopping.
A lot of Mary Lincoln's behavior seems to have been triggered, and we were talking about this before, by trauma and the many, many losses in her life, including three out of her four sons. So let's talk a little bit about after the death of Willie. This is in 1862. She turns to, I think this is the point where she turns to spiritualism.
I mean, that's when we find out about it, whether she was dabbling in it. But that's when it becomes, I think Elizabeth Keckley, her seamstress, tells her and other people. And she finds a merry band of people in D.C. who believe in this. And this was not unusual during the Civil War. As you know, we lost 700,000 men, maybe 750. Mm-hmm. And the bodies were never found, a lot of them. Like, people weren't able to bury their loved ones. Mm-hmm. And so this was a very big thing, finding mediums and trying to contact, your loved ones. And Lincoln went to a couple of these seances. Those people who write about Lincoln, a lot of the scholars, a lot of the male scholars, they don't believe that Lincoln believed it. They believed he was curious and he was humoring her. I'm not so sure. I mean, Lincoln himself said he was superstitious, and he might have been, curious, but also wanting to know what was there. You know, he lost these children, too.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting the way, the difference in the way people are portraying his behavior and her behavior. She is seen as hysterical for her mental health issues. He's seen as being, depressed. She's called superstitious and sort of wonky for looking for these spiritualists. He seems to have a similar kind of sensibility, but he doesn't get the same kind of reputation for it. You see this a lot in the story.
There's a double standard in mental illness. And in the 19th century with men, it was just, they're under stress, they'll be fine. It's a sign of their sensitivity, their empathy. Yeah. And with women, they're insane. And so he was not judged by his mental illness, but she was judged by hers. I mean, she should have never been declared insane. I mean, she probably had a myriad of mental illnesses but all of them could have been treated, all of them. And the most pronounced one was anxiety. And some believe she was bipolar, but that would have, there's some anxiety and mania in that too. But there was unquestionably a double standard on mental illness.
I want to go to the evening when Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. Another moment clearly of trauma. She's basically holding his hand when he's killed. But the way this story plays out, the way she is excluded from these last moments of her husband's life, they come and tell her he's died. She doesn't get a chance to go in and be with the men who were gathered there as they pray over the dying and then dead body of Abraham Lincoln. Can you sort of take us through that evening? Now, she's upset. That's sort of complicating what's happening here. She is really distraught. Talk about that evening.
It was a metaphor for the following 17 years. I mean, every man in Washington who was, prominent went by that bedside, but yet she only went in once an hour. And in fact, when they first bring him in and he's being treated and she's standing in the doorway, they ask her to leave. Mm. It's very tragic. And at one point she goes in at the end of his life, like at 7 in the morning, and she faints. And Secretary Stanton says, get her out of here.
Yeah.
And then when he passes, they don't come and get her. Which is really, I mean, to me, that was real the biggest travesty. And that's that ate at her for a long time, that she didn't get to say goodbye. I mean, she was a very religious woman, a pious woman. They should have invited her in for the prayer. And when she asked the minister, why didn't you tell me? He said, well, you know, people thought it was for the best that you didn't come in.
How do you describe the, talk about the year after Abraham Lincoln is killed. She stays in the White House with President Johnson's, permission for, I think, 5 to 6 weeks. Some people said she just sort of was staying too long. She doesn't really have a place to go in many ways. She doesn't have access to her husband's estate, not for quite a while, you were mentioning. Talk about this part of her life.
I mean, she's lost. I mean, they're trying to get her to go back to the house in Springfield, and she doesn't want to go because she has bad memories there. She has good memories, let me put it that way, and she doesn't want to be reminded of the loss. And she just, her future was so uncertain. Mm. And she believed the White House was her destiny. And now all of a sudden it was over, and she had to go find a place to live in Chicago. She decided she was going to go to Chicago.
Yeah.
It's profoundly sad. And I don't think anybody was really helping her. I mean, some of the men around her, David Davis and some others, they just were stuck on the fact that she had to go back to Springfield and move into that house because they owned the house to save money. And she didn't want to. And they didn't try to help her find an alternative. They also tried to dictate where Lincoln was going to be buried, and she put her foot down there. They wanted him buried in a single tomb in downtown Springfield, and she got wind of that, and she said, no, he's going to the cemetery, and it's going to be a larger tomb, so his deceased sons could join him. And, of course, she wanted to join him at some point. And she had to fight tooth and nail for that, and it ended up harming her reputation further, but she was right. She had every right to demand where he be buried. And she said in one letter to the governor, it will be a place that's visited for the rest of eternity. Globally, people will come. And you know, she was absolutely right. It is the second most visited cemetery in the country, next to Arlington National Cemetery.
You say in the book that Mary Lincoln would have been thrilled with the reactions to her death. Explain what you mean.
It was very, what's the word, respectful and celebratory. And the church was packed and people waited for hours. I mean, she was all about entertainment and socializing and pomp and circumstance. And she would have loved the flowers. Thousands of flowers were brought in from Chicago. And they were formed in the image of a gate, and she was going to go through the gate to meet Lincoln, and there were wonderful speakers and highly prominent people in the community were pallbearers. I will say that one of the things that didn't happen that's worth noting is that her son didn't speak, and he wasn't a pallbearer.
Yeah,
and I always found that fascinating that he could have chosen to speak and to say something nice about his mother, and he chose not to.
Where is her reputation now? Actually, let me ask it this way. What would it take to rethink Mary Lincoln or to change people's perception of it? I mean, besides the book like this, of course, which I think you're doing, but what's it going to take for people to get a deeper sense of who that woman was?
I mean, it's hard to say because this has been so ingrained, but I think I feel like people like myself are doing their part. You know, we get out there, and I was expecting more pushback on my narrative, and I have not gotten that. I've gotten enormous support from scholars. And so I think just getting the word out, I'm being invited to speak at prominent Lincoln repositories like the Abraham Lincoln Library. And so I think scholars are welcoming this new look. And I think what it takes is to just sort of present a new history and have people absorb it and get it in the history book so people understand it.
Lois Romano, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lois Romano. Her book is An Inconvenient Widow, The Torment, Trial, and Triumph of Mary Todd Lincoln. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West, on YouTube at KUER 90.1. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida. The program is produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.